From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. Today's guest is Dr. Kelly Camelford. Dr. Camelford is an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Rehabilitation and Counseling at the Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center in New Orleans. She's a licensed professional counselor supervisor, and her research focuses on adolescent counseling interventions, women's issues, and ethical issues in counseling. Prior to joining the faculty at LSU, Dr. Camelford worked as a high school counselor as well as a clinician in private practice. She reflected on her time as a school counselor and spoke about her strategies for involving parents in the counseling process.
We never want to make recommendations that people are just going to pass off. So how first, before we get to that place, do we really come to an understanding of what it is the parent needs or what their challenges are that are creating those barriers to either provide the child with what they need. So sometimes just having frank conversations, letting the parent guide, being honest, using plain language, not trying to sound uppity or like, here's my position, like just being real with them. And I think too, kind of using some of those Rogerian concepts of just being authentic, be yourself. Yes, you need to be professional, but I think sometimes when you're interacting with parents, you have to be approachable and that can be different.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Dr. Camelford discuss the benefits of integrating family counseling practices in a school setting, describe the challenging and rewarding aspects of working with adolescents, highlight strategies for effectively bracketing one's values within the counseling relationship, and share about the importance of vulnerability when seeking consultation. Dr. Camelford also describes the clinical importance of overcoming fear and embracing new challenges.
And then sometimes it's also, too, just doing the work builds the confidence. And so, you know, just saying, yeah, I know I can do this. I have the education. I have the training. I've been supervised really is how that then transitions into you building specialties. You can't become specialized if you never try it. So kind of just breaking down the barrier of your own fear of, can I do this?
Kelly began our conversation by discussing how her parents' sudden decision to divorce during her senior year and her not-so-helpful experiences with her school counselor during that time sparked her interest and desire to become a counselor.
I first thought about counseling in high school. I was a kid that in my senior year found out my parents were going to get a divorce, and I went to a Catholic high school where my guidance counselor was a nun, a chain-smoking nun, and all she did was talk about going to the state school for tuition and scholarship opportunities, and she had no clue that some of this stuff was happening amongst my family. And I think at that point, I thought about, like, man, it'd be nice to have somebody to talk to. My family did reach out and get me support through personal counseling, and so that was my first touch point with the field of counseling, was through kind of this family change and being forced to go to family and individual counseling. And that really made an impact on me. It made an impact on learning how to be vulnerable, learning that it's okay to feel different emotions, but then also kind of learning that, especially in the school setting, that the school I was at was really kind of lacking in some of the services that could be so important for kids. And so when I entered into college, I became a psychology major and was really passionate about the field of psychology. I still didn't know quite what I wanted to do when I graduated. I ended up coming back home and ended up in human resources at a local hospital system just because it was an opportunity where I could make money. I had been accepted into a master's program in counseling, but I wasn't quite sure if that really was the right path. So I actually deferred my master's entry because I was liking making money at the time, and that felt good. But through that time, I was like, oh, wait, you know, making money is nice for the first time, but I still felt like something was missing. And it was more of that call to be of service to others. And so after a year working at this hospital system in human resources, I went back to that same master's program, and they accepted me. And so I entered into that, and I had the goal of becoming a school counselor. Once again, from my own personal life, I just felt school counseling can be such a wonderful avenue for kids and adolescents to to get help, especially when maybe they feel like they can't ask their parents or guardians or loved ones for help. So I ended up doing my practicum experience in school counseling, fell in love with the school that I was at for that. I did my internship at a family services facility, which was a great experience too. It gave me some confidence to know I could have mandated clients or see just a variety of clients versus the school. But ultimately, upon graduation, I was then offered a school counseling position at the school I did my practicum work at. So to the happenstance and importance of really picking your fieldwork site and making a good impression and how that could potentially have an impact on your career. So then I was a school counselor at an all-girls parochial high school that had a mixed SES background. So it was great work. I worked mainly with sophomores and seniors doing academic, social, and then also the college piece, which really wasn't what I wanted to do. But, you know, there are appropriate and inappropriate job duties for school counselors. And I was able to kind of negotiate enough that I could do more of the appropriate pieces. So that's where I landed. And I was a school counselor for about 4 or 5 years. And in that time, I decided to go back and work on my doctorate. So I would work all day. And luckily, my doctorate program was about 15 minutes away from the school I worked at. So then I could hurry up, get in my car, and head to night class. I ate a lot of PB&Js during that time to go to night class to get that doctorate. But once I did that, I decided I really wanted to pursue counselor education and more of a clinical piece where I had more time with clients. School counseling sometimes feels like a Band-Aid and really referring out. So after I got my doctorate, I opened a private practice and saw mainly adolescents just because that was who was referring to me. And that's kind of where my comfort zone and my training and competencies were. And so while I was in private practice, I began adjuncting at some of the local universities. And a couple semesters, I was adjuncting at, you know, 2 or 3 universities and trying to maintain private practice, just trying to get my name out there since I kind of decided, you know what, I definitely want to teach. And so then through a couple of semesters of adjuncting and doing the private practice, I ended up becoming an assistant professor at my current university. And now I've been there going on 4 years. So things fly. So that's a little bit about my journey to where I am now.
Can you please say where your current university
is? Yeah, sure. So it's LSU Health Sciences in New Orleans. Yes, go Tigers.
National champion LSU Tigers. I just want to work that in for everyone listening.
I love that. Yes, we're very proud and excited. Our obviously LSU, our flagship is in Baton Rouge, and we're the health sciences, but we like to party with them through and through, and we believe in LSU, and we were very excited about that football game.
Well, I want to back up because you've had such an interesting and circuitous career up to this point to your time as a school counselor.
Sure.
You know, you said you went from like making money for the first time to going back to school and then getting into a profession. I guess we could give some informed consent to those considering becoming school counselors.
Sure.
It's not the most lucrative.
No, I took a salary cut when I left HR and went to school counseling.
But as a former school counselor myself, it's such a great job. Could you speak about maybe some of the elements of that job that you particularly enjoyed and maybe prepared you well for those next steps in your career?
I mean, just being in a high school setting is fun. Getting to go to a pep rally is a privilege. Hearing a group of girls sing together or play together. I mean, it's just a fun place to be. I also love school counseling because you get to see your students interact in various settings versus a clinical setting where you only see a client for, say, 45, 50 minutes a week. You know, here you get to see them in extracurricular activities or at lunch and interacting in social settings. So, you know, the environment of a school can be so just wonderfully exciting. It can also be stressful. And so the fact that I was at a school where the principal really got it and allowed us to do some personal counseling was also a really big plus for me. The principal knew that some of our students didn't have resources or tools to potentially seek some of the help that maybe they needed. So we got to really do some good work. And we would see a lot of students individually. We ran a couple of groups. I had one group where we had a couple of students who had lost parents, either through, you know, cancer or just unfortunate incidents. And so one of the groups I really was excited that we could run there was a group for kids who lost a parent. And they jokingly called it the Breakfast Club because they didn't want it to be announced of, oh, here's the grief group meeting. So it was our Breakfast Club. And just to kind of see the students interact and engage the seniors with the freshmen and be vulnerable together talking about missing their loved one was just great opportunities. So there's a lot of positives about being a school counselor. It also depends upon what type of environment, what school setting you're in. Sometimes parents can be wonderful advocates, and sometimes it can be really tough to get a hold of them. So there's so much to think about in regards to school counseling and the populations and what you may be expected to do depending upon your population.
It sounds like there was an effort to incorporate families in the process of growth and working toward the success of their student, yet sometimes that wasn't always feasible. Could you speak to kind of the benefit and I guess sometimes necessity of doing family work within a school setting to kind of work toward that student's goals?
Sure. You know, I think whenever you work with kids or adolescents, you have to work with the family because any work you do with a child or adolescent, if they're going to be put back into the same environments, then change really is not going to be feasible or possible. So I really believe that family work is very important, whether it's just touching base with a parent or giving them some parenting skills or providing some community resources, ways to just engage are going to be helpful. Obviously, research shows that when parents are involved or guardians are involved, that kids have better success in treatment for counseling. And that's the same for schools, too. When parents are involved in the school community, their children have more success. So as a school counselor, you know, we really need to be advocates to support families, acknowledge the challenges that they may have. You know, we had some parents who wanted to be involved, but frankly, were working two or three jobs. So how could they be involved in trying to come up with creative ways or solutions, having a parent meeting, you know, on a Monday night and providing pizza and childcare for the other kids so that they didn't have to find a babysitter or they didn't have to figure something out for dinner. So just trying to think creatively of, you know, how can we get families involved and engaged, because we know if there is the family involvement, that the success for the student and or if you take that to the clinical setting, the success for the client is going to be higher.
You described the objective as involved and engaged. And I think about what a challenging one-two punch that is, that you might entice them with childcare and pizza to become involved and to show up.
Yeah.
But then overcoming that hurdle of like, well, I'm here, I've met that obligation, mm-hmm. and creating that buy-in to drive the engagement.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to ask a parent to consider something that maybe they haven't considered or to approach something in mm-hmm. a different way that's not their default. How did you drive some of that engagement in working with parents that might be a bit reticent to buy into what it is that you're suggesting, even though you're framing it as like this really is in the best interest of your student?
I think sometimes, especially when I was a school counselor, I was young. I look young. It can be intimidating to go to parents and tell them, well, this is what you need to do, X, Y, or Z. So I think sometimes just how do you take a more Socratic approach? How do you really get information from the parents about what's working, trying to utilize the strengths-based approach, asking them for what's working, what's not working, how can I help, and trying to put things or phrase things in a way that the parent can really see the benefit, and that you're also validating the parent and understanding their challenges, because we never want to make recommendations that people are just going to pass off. So how first, before we get to that place, do we really come to an understanding of what it is the parent needs or what their challenges are that are creating those barriers to either provide the child with what they need. So sometimes just having frank conversations, letting the parent guide, being honest, using plain language, not trying to sound uppity or like, here's my position, like just being real with them. And I think too, kind of using some of those Rogerian concepts of just being authentic, be yourself. And yes, you need to be professional, but I think sometimes when you're interacting with parents, you have to be approachable, and that can be different.
That very much resonates with my experience working at parochial schools in the same area. And yeah, you know, even if parents are doing something that might not be ideal, I felt like for the most part, parents really, especially those working multiple jobs, are just doing the best they can with what they have. And I found, to be approachable and to not say it as if like, oh, you know, what you're doing is not enough or it needs to be done differently, but to say like, man, you're doing your best and I'm here to help you. Not like I want you to do more so I can do less. Like I want to do more along with you because we both believe in your child's potential and their ability to be more successful or to become healthier in whatever way. So I love the way that you characterize that. Another great thing I think about school counseling is how it's such a great training ground to get, you know, a lot of rich, diverse experiences with adolescents that can transition to having great clinical competence and experience just in building that rapport. Could you talk about your clinical work with adolescents and just noteworthy elements that maybe you enjoy about that or you find particularly challenging?
Sure. So what was kind of interesting, as a school counselor, you're doing a lot of triage and you're doing a lot of referrals. And so, you know, as a school counselor, I would make referrals. Oh, gosh, we have a suicidal kid, or we have a kid who's cutting, self-harm, or just feeling really big emotions. And so that felt really like overwhelming. And oh, my gosh, I can't believe this kid's in this position. Okay, but now I can just refer out. So whew, that's a little relief. Then when I got into private practice, all those school counselors who I knew and networked with were then referring those cases to me. So that was a bit overwhelming at first because it was like, okay, I used to just refer all of these cases. I knew they were out there. I know the students and I know the people, but this is usually where I would kind of pass the baton. And now the baton is getting passed to me. So the first kind of piece was to really build up what my skills and competencies were, doing a lot of reading on some of those topics, seeking supervision past my licensure supervision to see who's out there and what they were doing and how they were doing it were really big tenets that allowed me the confidence to see those type of clients. And so really some of my first private practitioner clients were adolescent girls with self-harm behaviors. And so that was a pretty drastic population to be working with. And I do feel like the school prepared me to kind of know the developmental levels of where students should be and where adolescents are and kind of what's typical development versus atypical. And it definitely gave me the basic tools of ethical decision making and knowing about self-harm and suicidal ideation, but then kind of transitioning into, okay, now I'm working with this client on a weekly basis or sometimes twice a week basis or whatever the appropriate kind of treatment was for that client. It definitely ramped up. So making sure I had tools and peers who were accessible to me, who could support me in those ventures was really important. And then sometimes it's also too, just do it. Doing the work and it builds the confidence. And so, you know, just saying, yeah, I know I can do this. I have the education, I have the training, I've been supervised, really is how that then transitions into you building specialties. You can't become specialized if you never try it. And so kind of just breaking down the barrier of your own fear of, can I do this? So that was kind of that interesting transition point, and really starting to expand your skills from a school setting to a clinical setting, because there are different skill sets utilized between school counseling versus a private practice setting. So really making sure you're kind of honed in on those pieces, and also from a private practice, learning the business side too. That was a whole new component that I don't think many clinicians and counselors think about. They think private practice sounds wonderful, and it can absolutely be, but some people just do not realize that they have to market and bill and do all of those logistical pieces that kind of come with just the clinical skills too. So it's a wide variety of things.
Can we go back to the importance of consultation, and maybe what were some of those issues or areas where you were looking to develop greater competence and to specialize in that just required that added effort to seek out consultation?
Sure. So I teach ethics, and the one thing I tell my students is if you remember anything from this class, it is to consult, 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 because that really creates the standard of care for what we're doing in our field. And we need to know what is it that other licensed professionals would do in a similar situation. And so consultation is huge. And not only to consult with people who are like-minded, but to also consult with people who have different opinions or orientations or even standards or licenses is important, because that kind of helps us find the blind spots that we may be having. So consultation to me is key. Consultation sometimes means being vulnerable, and that's okay. That's how you grow. That's how you become a better professional, by admitting and thinking about, ooh, I think I need some help around here. So some of the areas I either sought consultation or supervision was in some of these tough cases where the self-harm was really predominant. And I had a couple of clients who would end up hospitalized based on the self-harm. Not that they were trying to kill themselves, but just the severity of the cut or the self-harm behavior was so significant, and or it led to infection, that then they ended up being hospitalized a couple of times. And so for those cases, there was a lot of consultation and supervision, especially if I was going to recommend hospitalization or further evaluation. I want to make sure I'm you know, on the mark there and not scaring a family or creating a bad experience that then is going to threaten or subject a family to say, oh, well, we're not coming back to counseling ever again. This was a horrible experience. So I think, you know, I would consult and get supervision from previous professors, from people along the way in the profession that I met, whether they were other school counselors or I live in New Orleans. New Orleans is a very small place where you get connected pretty quickly. And so how do you just kind of find out, oh, this person works a lot with cutting, or this person works a lot with divorce. And so then how do you just start reaching out to those people and say, hey, you know, here's who I am. You have a moment. I'd love to consult. I'd love to get your perspective. And 99% of the time, they would say, absolutely. And I think that's the good part of our profession, is that most people want to support and help other professionals.
You teach ethics, and you're clearly knowledgeable and passionate about the topic, but it scares a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
They hear ethics, and it's spooky. What are some things that you feel like your students are especially afraid of, or novice clinicians might struggle with in the area of ethics, just because it can seem overwhelming and burdensome?
I think ethics is fun, but I know I'm kind of jaded in that way. I think a lot of new clinicians are just so worried that they're going to potentially hurt a client, and or what happens when you do have that high-risk client, like the suicide. I think anytime you say suicide to a student, they're like, oh, no, oh, my gosh, well, I don't want to see that. And it's not if, but when. You know, we're all going to have, with the work that we're doing, we're going to have a time in which we're most likely sitting with a suicidal client. And what a privilege it is that we get to have that that position. So I think first it's just like, how do we kind of teach creating a mindset and frame of the fact that we're privileged to be in this position and this situation? And then how do we kind of make sure we know what an ethical decision-making model is and what our tools and resources are in our toolkit so that we can do the job that we were trained to do? And I think a lot of things sound scary at first, but once you gain the tools and the experience, then it's not that it's still not overwhelming or concerning when they occur in a clinical setting, but you feel more confident and you feel like, you know what, this is part of my job. This is what I've been trained to do. And so here's my plan. So I think some students struggle with the high-risk clients. I think, too, right now, and this has been a trend in the field, is just the personal values piece and the bracketing. That's something I'm really passionate about. And I think, too, students can kind of pinpoint some of the bigger personal value pieces of, gender identity or interracial marriage. And those are great. That we're pinpointing those, but there are also smaller values that we don't think about that are in the subconscious. That I think, as new clinicians, we need to be thinking about how are we potentially bracketing our values so that we're not having an imposition or guiding or leading our clients into one direction or another. So I would say kind of the values piece, and maybe that's just because it's been such a hot topic in the field lately, but those are kind of the two that most of my students are kind of concerned about. Like, how do I truly bracket my values? And then what do I do with some of these high-risk populations?
So I know that our listeners kind of run a spectrum of where they're at in their education or their career. And I think like some of those, because they are so challenging, it's not necessarily like, oh, I have a master's degree and I perfectly bracket my values.
Right.
What are some of those ways in which you approach with your students kind of going through that process of self-reflection to bracket some things that might become an imposition on our clients that maybe might be helpful for someone at any phase of their career as something to reflect on and to practice, you know, on a consistent basis?
Yeah. So I like just mindfulness and anything related to bringing awareness to whatever variety of life we're struggling with or the challenges. And so sometimes just taking a personal inventory of where you're at. I also encourage students that they don't need to change their values, but they just have to learn how to bracket them. And so how, though, through time, whether your values stay the same, or sometimes our values change. You know, for instance, I had kids in the past 2 years. My values have changed based on that personal experience. And that's okay. But how do I really take the time to step back and acknowledge that, wow, this has been a big change and now I see things in a different way? And so I think it's really about how the self-care piece and how do you have the mindfulness to develop that awareness of what your motivations are and how they come into play. Thinking too about the transference or counter-transference pieces that come into play in a counseling session. How aware of you are you of when those pieces happen, and how does that potentially relate to a values piece? So, you know, I think it's good practice to every now and then just take a step back and think about what are the things that are important to you, what are the things that are not important to you, and what does that say about you, whether it's important or not important, and how could that potentially impact your client, depending upon what you value. So I think sometimes just taking a little bit more time for yourself, doing the self-care, implementing some mindfulness practices to evaluate, maybe doing a values card sort here or there just for fun. In my class, I do a values auction where they get 1,000 Camelford bucks and they have to, look at a set of values. And what's interesting is I'll have them, you know, write their values from the group for the values that are for sale. They have to write down which ones before the auction that they're trying to go for. And then after the auction is done, I have them kind of reassess, well, what were the values that they actually bid on, or how did that list change based on what other people were bidding, or if they really wanted to wait for another value. And so, you know, I think you can do some of this in fun ways. It doesn't have to be necessarily some serious reflection, but just taking the time out to just gain perspective and insight is so important when it comes to the values piece.
You also stressed the importance of self-care. Earlier, you talked about how you would drive from your full-time job and eat PB&J to go to your night class, which is way healthier than what I would do, which was go from, and you had a 15-minute drive. I had an hour drive, and I would go from my full-time job and eat Wendy's or Popeyes before class.
Delicious.
Which was not necessarily self-care. But how have you attended to your own self-care in the midst of your busy and demanding life? Because someone out there could say, like, oh, wow, like, you know, you're a mom of young kids.
Yeah.
And you have a full-time job as a professor, and you do clinical work, and you just want to have a life of your own. Like, how do you do all of that?
I think it's really important to set boundaries and to, I will say I'm a type A person. So I set goals and deadlines. And I think if I can kind of set up what is expected, then I really function with that. I think too, at the time of my life when I was working at full time as a school counselor and then working full time on my doctorate, that was a very stretched time. I was a newlywed, just bought a house, trying to do all of these things. And I just kind of put my head down, and like each semester I would say, okay, I've got 3 months, I've got 4 months, it's going to be super busy. But then the one benefit of being a school counselor was that I had off summer. And so what I did during that time is I actually took off from work because I could, because I was a school counselor. But I also took off from my doctorate program, and I did not take summer courses. And so that was a wonderful time for me to just fully recharge and get to go do things with family and friends that I had really put off during the work and school piece. So for me, that kind of worked. Now it's so funny because I look back on that, I'm like, how did I do that? But sometimes too, when you have a goal and you have something, it just drives you because you're just so excited for what's to come and the opportunities that can come from, you know, having that degree. So I think that just kind of motivated me on those tough days. But definitely taking breaks and kind of having the idea that, okay, this too shall pass. I will get through it. And now it's more about setting boundaries. Like I do not answer email after 5 o'clock. I do not answer email on the weekends. So for my students, if they've got an assignment due Monday morning, I'm so sorry if you're trying to ask me about the page length or something about that assignment Sunday night, but you should have done that before. So, you know, just kind of setting some boundaries so that way I can spend time with my family and do some of these things and enjoy the position of where I'm at and kind of get more of a balance. So to self-care, I used to, and I'm trying to get back into the exercise piece, but being a new mom has definitely changed some of that. But just getting home and playing with my kids, that's self-care. That's really fun. And they're only little so often and so much. So, you know, self-care has evolved and looks a little different now too. And that's okay.
Yeah, like putting first things first. Like when you're at work, like during those days and those times, like that is a priority.
Right.
And almost being able to say, like, you can't do everything or be everything to everyone every day.
Yeah.
And it seems also like you avoided the pitfall of feeling like you needed to do everything as quickly as possible. That maybe in order to be in this for the long haul, there needed to be those breaks where summer was just time for you.
Yeah.
Rather than getting to where you're at as soon as possible. It's like staying where you're at as long as possible.
Yeah. I think part of that too kind of comes in like the reframe of like, I need patience. And that's always been something that's been hard for me. I'm typically a go-getter, but the idea that like, what's a couple of months in the grand scheme of things? Is your sanity and having some time off going to be better now than just trying to charge through and stressing yourself out when if it's May or August, is that really that big of a difference? For some people, it may be. For others, it's not. So I think, once again, like, how do you take yourself inventory of what's important and what's not? And how do you make sure you're paying attention to what you feel is important and honoring it in that way?
You do a lot of work now with adolescents and also parents of adolescents. Could you talk about that work?
Yeah, it's interesting how I feel like my career just kind of keeps evolving. And so students are like, oh, this is what you're going to do. And it's like, well, no, actually, things are still changing, which I think is great. I really never saw myself as a play therapist. But then when I got on with LSU, we have a play therapy center. So I ended up getting a play therapy credential, which is great because I kind of come from a standpoint that you can never have enough education. Like, education is so important to the work that we're doing and training. So I've continued my work with adolescents, and then I've kind of tagged on some of these parenting pieces. So learning about programs like Triple P, getting certified in PCIT, which is parent-child interaction therapy. And so just once again, when you kind of get to an environment, how can you build yourself in regards to your experience, credentials, training, so that you can be the best that you can in that given environment. And so it's been really fun. I still see a ton of adolescents, but I've actually been shifting to do more parents and parenting pieces, which is helping me grow and kind of keeps me energized because I'm doing something a little different while still maintaining that adolescent base. But it's an exciting time. And I think it just goes to show the flexibility and the opportunities that really are in our field, that you can really do a variety of things within one career path.
What are some of those common prison issues that those who are looking to do counseling with parents might encounter? And maybe good educational or continuing ed resources to develop competency in those areas.
Yeah, well, I think if you're wanting to work with itty bitties or little kids doing just some play therapy or filial therapy, and so Landreth is like he's the mecca of some of those child-centered play therapy approaches and child-parent relation therapy, CPRT. So those factors, they're typically classes that you can take, and there's tons of trainings that he himself has offered and or that are available online. Association for Play Therapy is a great association and resource if you're looking to work with kids and or maybe some of their parents for the younger population and doing some of the filial pieces. For other parenting pieces, there are a lot of just different certification programs out there. So you don't necessarily have to have a license for some of them. Some of them are just parent management programs that are out there. They have a clearinghouse that's online. And of course, I'm blanking on, I think it's the California Clearinghouse of evidence-based protocols, where you can go and see, type in parent programs for different age groups and different symptomologies or diagnoses of kind of what's recommended. That's a wonderful tool because, too, we really want to use evidence-based interventions in the work that we're doing. So really kind of just seeking out those programs that have that stamp of approval from an evidence-based perspective are important. And then kind of seeking out, a lot of them have their own training components and or workbooks or manuals that you can seek out. And some of them you can start utilizing in your master's or doctoral level. And then others you would need a license in order to gain further credentials. But there's a lot out there to explore. Kind of depends, too, on just what your theoretical orientation and what path you want to go, really. It's interesting, the filial piece and the child center piece are wonderful and is something I do. However, I also am doing this PCIT, which is more of a behavioral-based approach. And so they are really opposites. And so it's been interesting to try and learn the verbiage and catch myself in sessions with clients in regards to what approach I'm utilizing. But, you know, it's once again kind of, to me, like, how do we kind of take all of this in? And I know in master and doctoral programs, you're taught, you know, pick a theory, stick with it. But how is it that we really are more eclectic? And how do we kind of try to make sense of all of these pieces? And so I'm kind of one that believes in moderation. Don't go to the extremes. How do we, on the continuum of things, find the middle ground and kind of work from that perspective?
If there's someone out there listening who's maybe on the fence about like, oh, you know, should I do work with parents and parenting training or not? What are some of the especially rewarding and enjoyable aspects of that line of work?
I think it can be wonderful when parents have like an aha moment. I think so often parents are really struggling. They want to support their kid. They want to help their kid, but they just don't know how, or because they're kind of caught in their own traps of how they grew up or their own anxiety and or depression that they just don't know how to help kids. And so I think sometimes kids perceive when they come to counseling as their parent just not knowing what to do with them. And so now I'm here. And so when parents get involved, either through just like parent consultation or through a more kind of rigorous parenting program, I think it just creates a wonderful communication path for the child and the parents. And I've seen parents just go from, you know, really being harsh to their children and yelling because they think that's the only way the child's going to listen, to just really opening up and validating and having just more affectionate relationship and engaged relationships. So I think it's wonderful when parents really want to learn some new parenting tips, because once again, most parents don't, you know, they read what to expect when expecting, but then they don't read anything once the kid gets here. And so their training to be a parent is typically based on how they were parented and or what they see out there in the community or through TV or other forms of media. So I think it's so awesome when parents want to be vulnerable and own up to say, you know what, we could use some help too, instead of just throwing a kid or adolescent in counseling. And I think that speaks volumes to the kid too, that the parents role modeling that they need to make changes too. And that sticks.
Are there other aspects of your work that we haven't touched on yet that you're especially passionate about, or that in encountering those experiences recently, they've been really energizing?
I would say, too, from the work that I'm doing with parents, it's then kind of transcended into working with moms and women's issues. And so that's been, too, something kind of new and different. I never really saw myself as an adult clinician, but I'm becoming more of one from the parenting work. And then I've ended up with some clients whose kids are in our clinic, and then the women have been referred for counseling services for things like anxiety, depression, work-life balance, transitions. So maybe we've had some moms who have been working and now they're transitioning to being stay-at-home or vice versa. So those have been really interesting components and pieces. And then from that has also kind of stemmed an interest into perinatal issues. And so that is from the time of, you know, anything that's happening in pregnancy or in the attempts of fertility pieces to then kind of a year after birth. So some of the postpartum pieces. So I'm actually going next week to get trained in perinatal mood disorder, which I'm really excited about, because once again, I think it just complements some of the services I've already been providing parents. And it'll just be a new lens to have in my toolbox for sure.
Earlier, you mentioned transference and countertransference, and I can't help but hear some of your experiences through the lenses of my experience. And so, you know, you mentioned looking young for your age, and that's something that has been a struggle of mine as someone who doesn't look like he's nearly 40, yet I am. How have you handled that in like the serious, important, grave work that you do with people who are looking to make sense of these things? For, you know, much of that time, you're helping parents, and they're probably asking, like, well, do you have kids yet? And maybe for a time, like, except within the past few years, the answer would have been no.
Yeah.
And looking young for your age, how have you broached those topics, or how have you navigated in a way that maybe put the client at ease or just was honest and vulnerable?
Yeah, I think sometimes it depends on the relationship or the rapport I have, whether I kind of take a more like professional approach, or if maybe I try to make a joke or make it kind of more light of a situation. But this is something too, I'll even tell students that, you know, because I think a lot of people are fearful of, oh, well, the client is going to ask, well, you don't have kids, or you don't have addiction, or you don't have whatever, fill in the blank. But it's like, you know what? Did your cancer doctor have cancer? No. And they still treated you for cancer. So just because the person doesn't have something or doesn't experience it doesn't mean that they're not qualified. And so I try to really bring up that piece that although maybe before when I didn't have kids, or the fact that I don't have adolescents, that doesn't mean I don't have the qualifications to do my job. And so how do we kind of tease it out, and how through potentially the fact that I don't have that makes me almost more qualified because I don't have those assumptions or counter-transference issues that could potentially pop up. So I try and just spin it a little bit and talk about how the training is so important and the skill set. And sometimes, too, kind of looking younger has worked to my benefit or advantage with an adolescent population, because some of the parents are like, oh yeah, they'll like you, they'll think they can relate to you more. So I mean, once again, sometimes it can be good, sometimes it can be bad. So I think you just kind of have to figure out ways to take it in and know that it's there, and know that, you know, it's something you may have to address in a professional way.
But just kind of owning it and being comfortable with it.
Yeah.
It's the reality that you live in, and so it's going to come up, and just being able to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. And as we wrap up, I want to end the podcast, as I end all of the podcasts, by asking you to think about a time in your life where maybe you thought about something in a certain way, or you were going through a situation and just what that experience was like was not as positive or as helpful as it could be. And you step back and you reframe that reality, and that had a positive impact on how you move forward.
In 2015, I actually applied for an assistant professor position at LSU Health Sciences, and I ended up not getting it. And I was really crushed at the time. I really thought, oh, I have it. I know I have the qualifications. I know this would be wonderful because I didn't have to move cities. I really wanted to stay in my hometown. And so I just thought, oh my gosh, this position, it's going to be perfect. I really nailed the interview. And I remember my department chair called me and said, look, we really liked everything you had. You're a great candidate, but we're not going to offer you this position. And in that phone call, it was like, whew, first I had to like take a gulp to kind of listen to the butt and to listen to the fact that she was still talking. And right in that moment, I realized, okay, I had an opportunity, because she was telling me about how it looked like, you know, some things were potentially going to come down the pipeline, and if I would adjunct and continue to stay in touch and just continue to promote myself and work on my resume and my CV, that maybe something would come down the line at a later date. And so I kind of had to take, I mean, she couldn't offer me, and she did not offer me a position at that point. And so that was kind of a turning point. Like, do I just say like, oh, wash my hands of this? I tried, it didn't work. I don't think I could go back. I'm ashamed, or, you know, feeling like, if I couldn't get it the first time, why would I try again? But that wasn't the attitude I took. The attitude I took was, you know, there are a lot of qualified professionals in our field, and the person who they hired, who is now my like work BFF, was more qualified than I was. She had more years of experience, and she had some experience doing things that I did not. And it is totally understandable why they hired her over me. And it's just funny how things work out. But at the time, it was just like, it felt like such a setback. But the fact that this person said, you know, stay in touch, keep doing what you're doing. You never know what'll happen. That was enough for me to say, okay, I need to just brush off. I need to keep doing what I'm doing. And at some point I will be successful. So, I ended up reaching out to her. I'd go to some of their workshops. I would offer to go do guest lectures. I ended up adjuncting at LSU Health Sciences so that they could really see my skill set. And then a position did eventually open up, and I'm sure, and I know there were other candidates. But I think because of the hard work and the dedication and the experience that, then it ended up being my time. And this position was actually a better fit in regards to the job duties and how that all unfolds. And so here I am and working towards promotion and taking advantage of all the pieces. But you really had to reframe to not let that impact you in a way. Or I should say it did impact me, but for the better, not to be jaded or envious or for the worse. But it really gave me a year to improve myself and to work on some of those skill sets that I was lacking in the field of counselor education. And how could I repair those or add to it so that I could just make myself a more viable candidate? And so that's what I chose to do. And it paid off. And that was for me, maybe not for all, but, that was a really good reframe. And so that's something I try and carry with me, all the time, that there is, you can have all the experience in the world, but there are other people who are going to be way more qualified. And how do you just kind of take in the fact that you're a hard worker, but there's also some planned happenstance that comes in the way, and how do you kind of give it up to a higher power or whatever your belief system is to say, you know what, this didn't work out, but there is something better for me in store, and just kind of keep moving forward instead of letting it be a setback.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.